All right, I'm ready.
Good morning. I'm Darrell Gunter, your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM and streaming on the net at WSOU.net. Well, today I'm so happy to have as our in-studio guest, Mr. Patrice Jones, who is a longtime publishing executive with Pearson, who now has his own company, but I'm not going to steal your thunder there. Patrice, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, I'm so excited to talk about how we met is that former friend, colleague of David Parker, and I saw a post on LinkedIn where you had posted the Washington Post article about DeSantis with his bill. But before we jump into that, could you share with our audience a little bit about your education and background?
Okay. I am a deep product of HBCUs in that both of my parents are career faculty at HBCUs, going from Clark Atlanta to Prairie View to Mississippi Valley, Howard University. My brother and sister also attended HBCUs. I went to Southern University in Baton Rouge. Uh-huh. And then I did my grad work at the University of Iowa, which is the first time I ever was in a situation where I actually was a numerical minority, because I'm from Atlanta originally also.
Right. Okay.
So that would be my educational background. I worked for, after grad school, I got a job as a publishing rep at Pearson. I left grad school much to the chagrin of my parents to try to start a hip hop record label. I was ABD
okay.
in political science.
Uh-huh.
That you can imagine how that went over. but I got a job as a publishing rep, got promoted into marketing, rose up through that ranks to become ultimately vice president of marketing for two different divisions. And then they started realizing how important consistent branding was, and they created a centralized creative group. Because in higher ed, we had people essentially marketing the same product with different messages because there was internal competition.
Right, right.
And so they stood up an internal creative group and tapped me to run it. And I did that from 2010 through the time that I ended up leaving, which was in 2018.
Okay.
And then within that, I had moved from being like higher ed to then global higher ed. So I've seen a lot on the marketing side of publishing, talked to a lot of customers, and created a lot of content.
You know, I was very moved by your comments. It was very deep and thought provoking, as a call to the publishing industry to take note of this bill. But tell us about what about this article in this and DeSantis's bill to defund the DEI programs that prompted you, that motivated you to write that post on LinkedIn.
So the bill is not surprising, right? It's just a continuation of what we've seen at the policies from DeSantis, from Abbott in Texas, and kind of this right-wing focus on creating this boogeyman of critical race theory and then tying everything to it without any real honesty about what critical race theory is. And then beyond that, in terms of where it actually lives. And I'm sure you know this, right? That critical race theory, first thing I want to say is there is nothing wrong with critical race theory. Critical race theory is simply saying that America was founded in a racist paradigm, which is undeniable. Race was created in order to justify slavery, in order to create a way to distinguish between white indentured servants, black indentured servants, and enslaved people, to create then a caste system so that these white indentured servants and poor whites had a status which was basically defined as not being African, not being black. And that created an atmosphere where black people could be subjugated and white people would be satisfied with that rung in the ladder. If you read Caste by Isabel Wilkerson, she lays all of this out. So there's, and to the point where after the invention of the cotton gin in 1860, I think the highest concentration of millionaires in the United States were in the Mississippi Delta. the value of slaves, not the work of slaves, but the value of enslaved people exceeded the value of all the railroads and all the manufacturing in the entire country. So clearly this economy was built on slave labor. That's at the core of central race theory, as I understand it. So first of all, so the idea to put it out there as the boogeyman is just like the way they put the word woke out there as the boogeyman.
Right.
And then people on the left, they back off of that stuff. Oh, I'm not saying I'm woke. I'm just saying that I care about the world. Oh, that's not critical race theory. It's something else. Well, it's not critical race theory, but let's not act like critical race theory is some wild leftist screed, where it's really history. And it's something that we understand about the way our culture, our society flows out of our economy. So there's that. So what I see seeing with this article with DeSantis is just a continuation of that, right? So to say, we're not going to put any more money into DEI, and we're not going to allow DEI, any funding for DEI at schools, at higher ed institutions, right? So that's problematic, obviously, because the work around diversity, equity, inclusion, and now belonging is really important work. I don't think there's any denying that people from marginalized groups need vigilance around helping them maintain or gain access to some of these core American institutions, of which education is probably maybe the most important place, right? Because this is how we form, particularly in higher ed, this higher level critical thinking about the way the world works and then how to address issues in the world. So that's one thing. And then, you know, the other piece of it is around taking these subjects that, oh, you can't teach critical race theory is the one they called out. But then the one thing they talked about was being even more concerned about, even in an African-American studies program, now you've got, you know, the DeSantis police kind of reviewing the syllabi and the curriculum to see, you know, like what within an African-American studies program you can talk about and what you can't talk about. That's just now how education works. And so I think to publishers, right? Because I've been in those rooms where we're trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to, you know, quote unquote, make our number, right? And it all comes down to, you know, these big adoptions, University of Texas, University of Florida, Miami-Dade Community College. These are all these schools that you be in the, and we call them war rooms. And you're like, are we going to get this business? You know, and who have you talked to and who do you know and how many copies is that? And so I understand that saying, you know what, DeSantis is tripping. We're not gonna alter our content for Florida. This just isn't right, right? If you know anything about the way capitalism works, it's very difficult within a corporate standpoint to say, rather than chase the money, we're gonna do the right thing, right? And I think up until a certain point, in publishing, right? Publishing was kind of this interesting halfway place between corporate America and education. You were to some extent, I think, insulated from those kind of decisions, right? It's not like you worked in big tobacco,
right?
Right, or you were polluting the environment, right? Everybody was on board with trying to educate people, and I think the moral dilemma was around how much to charge for what you were selling,
right.
But I think this is a different place now, right? We're in a spot now where there are people who are actively trying to diminish the benefit of education towards society at large for political gain,
mm-hmm.
right? Ron DeSantis himself, I don't know him, but I am sure he probably does not give a hoot whether or not people are learning about Black history or not. But what he knows is, the currency that he's trading in, which is the votes of non-college educated whites, cares,
mm-hmm.
right? And they also care about doing things that agitate the people they view as being the radical left, right? So anything that makes people like me holler or write LinkedIn posts, that's a win. That's what they're here for. They're not here to gain status against the white establishment. They're just trying to stay ahead of me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. So the fact that I'm riled up about it, that's a good win. Send immigrants to Martha's Vineyard. That's a win. That does nothing to address a problem.
Right. Right.
But it makes the people that they hate mad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a win. You know, and so DeSantis is playing for that. But the thing is, he's making the currency of it education, right? The ability for people to understand the world and to address so many of the issues that are really, a check is coming due on a lot of this stuff, including climate change.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so to take these kinds of stands in order for political gain, is I think that's the most criminal part about it, right? More so than, you know, I don't know if you saw today in Miami Lakes, they banned Amanda Gorman's speech, that the poem,
saw it
the
last
poem that she read. Yeah,
I was watching Joy Reid last night, and also the guy who comes on after her. I think he covered it. Where her speech is banned.
Right. Now, this is one place. This is Miami Lakes. And apparently one parent raised it. Right. And they went and they jumped on it and said, yeah, you're right. You're not going to be the hill to climb or whatever the name of it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to minimize these incremental affronts, right? Because they add up.
Right.
But the point of it was, again, to anger us, to make us upset. Right. And again, that's a win, right? The fact that it gets in the news is a win. And I don't think the answer is to not get upset about it, but the answer is to realize that this is the tactic.
Exactly. Because when our time and attention is drawn to these particular activities, that's time and attention that we can't put to more productive, right?
Right. Exactly. And it's so interesting to watch all this stuff play out and understand. You know, I maintain that the way politics in this country works is that the currency you need to get in office is votes. But the people you represent once you get in office are the wealthy class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. So you do this song and dance to people, you know, who are actively working against their interests. The GOP actively works against the interests of poor white people, right? But the thing that they do that appeals to poor white people is say, we will make sure that your status as being above Black folks and Mexicans and Native Americans is solid. We will not let them pass you up. And that's enough. There's a book called, go ahead.
There's the famous quote from President Lyndon Baines Johnson. I think it was Mississippi he was in. It was at a fundraiser, that evening they were having something to drink, what he said was, and this quote has been published widely, he says, you could tell the lowliest of white man that he's better than the best Negro, and you could pick his pocket, you could pick his pocket.
There's a book by a woman's name is Hothschild. It's called Strangers in Their Own Land. Have you seen that? Have you read that?
I have not. Mm-mm.
So she wanted to understand why poor white people vote against their interests. And she spent 5 years in Louisiana.
Uh-huh.
She's from Berkeley. 5 years in Louisiana. And she used the environment as her keyhole issue.
Okay.
To understand why people who in many cases moved to Louisiana because of the bayous and the hunting and the fishing, who now have whole weeks where they can't go outside because of the smell, right? Where they have the highest cancer rates in the nation. And there's no doubt that it's from these chemical refineries and these oil refineries, right? Right. And they continued at the time, they were talking about, why would you vote for Bobby Jindal? Right. And they also know that refineries are not labor intensive. Right. So they're not bringing a lot of jobs into the community. And what she found was, and it was corroborated by the people that were there, is that they see the pursuit of the American dream as a line, as a queue. And it doesn't matter if they never get to the front of the line, as long as they don't get passed up by people who shouldn't be in front of them. And they saw Barack Obama as the ultimate line cutter, right? He's the dude that sneaks into movies and lets his boys in the back door in their minds, right? So it didn't matter if you were literally killing them, as long as you were committed to not letting people jump you in line that weren't white. And that was the conclusion of our book, and it's very compelling. I would encourage everyone to read it. But if you look at what you see happening through that lens, it begins to make sense, right? And it's why there's so much focus on non-college educated whites. And it's not saying that these are people who are not intelligent. What it is saying is these are people who have not taken certain steps that would put them in a position to move up status-wise in the white world.
Mm-hmm.
So then all they have is their relative position
mm-hmm.
to these marginalized people.
Right. Right.
And so that becomes such a power, to Lyndon Johnson's point, that becomes a very powerful position politically to say, I will protect your status to make sure that you don't drop, because status is a relative concept.
Right.
So if Black folks move up, even if you're in the same place, you get passed by a bunch of Black people, you have moved down. Right? So they're not going to go up.
Right.
Right. They got that on lock, right? That echelon, like within that world, but they can make sure, or they can at least tell them that they can make sure that Black people, Native American people, Mexicans, whoever, are not going to come up. Right. Yeah. And that's such a powerful message for them. And they glom onto anything that even smells like that in terms of making a political stance.
Right. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Mr. Patrice Jones, an executive from the educational publishing industry, talking about Governor DeSantis' bill to defund DEI programs in Florida colleges. Question. Now, you have really laid out a very good theory in regards to the currency that DeSantis is looking to achieve. My question for you is that how long can he get away with these type of tactics, considering the population shifts in Florida?
So I think what you see happening, though, is there is a... So first of all, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar had this quote that racism in the United States is like dust in the air, right? That you don't see it until the light comes on, then you realize it's everywhere, that you're breathing it in, it's all over the place. And that is to say that there are some principles of white supremacy. And when I say white supremacy, I don't mean being a Klansman. I mean the view that there is something superior about whiteness. This country was built on that. And everybody has some element of that ethos in them, regardless of race.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it affects all of us in different ways. And so it's just a matter of you become aware of it and you start more you think critically about it. So that is just to say that the makeup of the population does not necessarily reflect the makeup of the political views.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. There is a lot of, you know, like Uncle Ruckus on Boondocks, man. There are a lot of people who vote against their own interests. And the other thing about Florida that people talk about is there's this weird thing where we take people who speak the same language as Hispanics, and we think that that's a race, right? There are a lot of white Cubans who identify as white and who share the interests of white people. And in Florida, that's really a significant portion of that population. So I think it's misleading to think that the racial makeup in Florida somehow is shifting drastically towards non-white people, or people who don't identify as white.
You know, my wife, Deb, has said that for years.
Mm-hmm.
Years, you know, and how folks want to assimilate to say that they're Caucasian.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how caste systems work. Right. It creates who's ever at the top. That's the aspirant object. Right. And so there's that. And then the other thing is DeSantis doesn't have to do it for long. He's trying to get another job.
Right. That's right. That's right.
Right. So another year. Another 18 months, he's good. Right. So, you know, I don't think it's a question of how long he can do it, but I think this is something that we see. It's not just about DeSantis. I think we see this across the GOP. And the interesting thing that they're working against is the thing that you're talking about, because the demographics of the United States are shifting. Right. And in fact, that's what's got them heated.
Right.
That's what's provoked them into this kind of hyperactivity. And what they're working to do is not necessarily to change the makeup, even though they are with immigration and things like that. And also, a lot of this anti-abortion stuff has to do with, like, no, we need to keep having white babies. So I get that. But what they're really doing is trying to cut democracy off at the knees. Right? So you've got places that are 50-50, but when you look at, you know, the legislature has a super majority. Look at North Carolina. You know, and when I say 50-50, I mean in terms of Democrats and Republicans. It may not necessarily be race-wise, but race goes into that. But they're actively working to try to create ways to circumvent what would be thought of as majority rule.
You know, the story I always love to tell, and as my wife says, when I tell her a story, she allows me to tell at least 10 times. Then she'll go, okay, well, you've used up your 10, but for my audience, they might not. But in 1993, I was promoted to be the national sales director for Dow Jones Financial News Services. And I moved from Chicago to back to New York. And there was a conference that was back in Chicago for the Securities Industry Association. And the topic was diversity. They had a Asian American gentleman from Charles Schwab in from California to talk about the changing demographics of the United States. This was 1993. And in the room, there was a couple hundred folks. I was the only Black person in the room. There was a few white women. In the West were white men. And after he finished his talk was about the changing demographics, how you're going to need to, you know, go beyond your normal hires, hire people from different backgrounds and whatnot. The look on the folks' face was terror. They weren't ready for that message. And that has stayed with me, really. I mean, it's, you know, I could still see their faces and like, oh my God, what are we gonna do? You know, but the thing about it is that despite all of the gains that folks have seen by having a diverse workforce, you're right. It's that caste system that, to use your phrase, that holds them back from really allowing this country to achieve a next level of prosperity.
Right. I agree 100%. You know, I've been doing some work. We're creating a video series in my new company to
And what is the name of your new company, by the way?
Enlight Media.
Nice, very
And
nice.
we do educational content. We've been working with publishers, we work with universities, we do marketing content, but we also do a lot of, you know, the core educational content. And what we're working on now is a series. The first series is on anti-Black racism in the United States from 1619 to January 6th. And the idea is we're trying to supplement or augment existing DEI training with historical context to add urgency to the work, right? Because DEI training tends, particularly in corporate situations, is about playing nice in the sandbox. And so what we do is we focus on the evolution of institutional racism, right? With the underlying premise being that, guess what? You work at an institution, and you probably work at an institution that made a lot of promises and commitments in the summer of 2020 about work that they were going to do both internally and outside of the organization's walls. And it's very hard to get companies who aren't doing anything or haven't committed to anything to pony up and try to make a difference internally and externally. It's a very different thing to try to hold your company accountable for promises that they've already made, for commitments that they've already made. And so what we're trying to do, and we're marketing this towards companies that consider themselves to be purpose-driven, right? So if you're a purpose-driven company, let's talk about how these systems have evolved over time for the same purposes to benefit the same people. And let's talk about the need for companies. If you think about the impact that a company can have, like when Nike backed Kaepernick, when Major League Baseball pulled an All-Star game out of Atlanta like 2 years ago,
right.
When the NBA All-Star game pulled out of Charlotte over the bathroom bill. Like, companies are institutions also, and they can have leverage in ways like this. Fight DeSantis, this guy going with Disney.
Right.
Right. You're not just going to walk all over Disney. Right. And so, and these companies, and I have no misconceptions about what their motivations are.
Oh, right? Sure. They're there to make a profit.
But a lot of them are trying to make profit over off the people who are going to still be alive in 30 years. And exactly. There's a concept, there's an idea that the younger people are more left-leaning than the older people. I'm sure that's the equation that Nike was running, right, and deciding what to do about Cap.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? They're like, we don't need the New Balance crowd. You know what I mean?
And you know, so, and I think to your point, I think what we're going to see is what I like to call ethical profitability.
Mm-hmm.
Where yes. Corporations are making profits, but the ethics are at a higher level than what they currently are right now.
Yep. I always said that the thing that Trump did was he wiped out the middle, right? There's no fence to ride.
Right. Right.
Right. So you got to be on one side or another. That was so clear. That's the summer that George Floyd was murdered, is that you couldn't be like, I don't have an opinion.
Right. Right.
You know, we're not political. Well, no, everything is political. And so you got to pick a side. And I think the side where the profits are for a lot of businesses and a lot of big brands is on the side of progress. It's on the side of diversity, mm-hmm. Which is why the other reason why I think so much of the focus is on education, because in the summer of 2020, you saw who was out there in the street getting beat by cops. It was young white kids.
Right.
Right. And I think that's also a reason that they're a little shook about these diversity initiatives and what they're teaching in these colleges. Because I think they've lost the young people, or they may be afraid of you losing the young people. And so they're trying to cut that off. But the interesting thing is, I don't think the information is coming through the schools. I think the information is coming through the internet.
Mm-hmm. You know, interesting. We got a couple minutes left. You had mentioned something in our pre-interview prep about, yeah, you can ban books, but there's something called the internet where folks can get access to information. Mm-hmm. So it's all about that currency. Can you just talk about that real quick before we close it?
So I'm sure your experience and publishing also, we all understand that college, any high school, college is where people read because you make them read. The internet is where people go to find out stuff that they want to know about.
Yeah.
Right. And so banning a book probably makes it actually more interesting. Right. Because they don't want you to read it. And so I think the banning of books and curriculum and stuff like that is, I think it's a very antiquated way of thinking about how people consume information and gain information. And certainly what we saw is the passion that people had around equality and around racism. And if people are that passionate about it, then banning the books is not going to do anything. They're just going to pick their phones up. And by the way, the books in school, they're like, did you learn about this in school? Even when I was in school, the perspectives that you got around racism were very mild, you know, compared to what I was getting in my house from my parents.
Right.
And the community that I was a part of, like what they call the left now, when I was growing up was center, if not center right.
Right.
You know, we just interviewed Angela Davis yesterday.
Nice.
Right. And she talked about the role of the Communist Party in the civil rights movement with Paul Robeson and William L. Patterson, and how, you know, the link between being anti-racist and anti-capitalist were tied together inextricably. That's a tough word sometimes, right? And so my point is that these truly progressive ideas exist, and they're going to be circulated, and they weren't in textbooks anyway.
Wow. Wow. Well said, sir. Believe it or not, we're out of time, but I want to thank our guest, Mr. Patrice Jones. coming on and talking about this topic about what does it mean to critical race theory, being woke, and DEI. Patrice, thanks for coming on the program.
Man, thanks for having me. I'm really glad you called me.
Oh, I'm happy you said yes. So ladies and gentlemen, that wraps it up this week on Leadership with Darrell W. Gunter on WSOU 89.5 FM and streaming on the net at WSOU.net. Want to wish you to have a great weekend, but most of all, remember, leadership begins with you.